From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, filling in for Terry Gross. Madonna had a hit with one of his songs, Richard Pryor asked him to write a biographical screenplay, Ornette Coleman played on one of his albums. On today's Fresh Air, Joe Henry. He's a singer-songwriter who records his own CDs and produces albums by performers whose music he loves. His new CD is called Civilians. Also, Elvis Costello. 30 years ago, he released his first album, My Aim Is True. Now there's a new anniversary edition. And film critic David Edelstein reviews In the Valley of Ella, starring Tommy Lee Jones and written and directed by Paul Haggis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Joe Henry is a singer-songwriter who has recorded a dozen albums of his own, but also is a sought-after record producer for albums recorded by other artists. One of those artists is Elvis Costello, and we'll hear from him later on today's show. Joe Henry's first album, Talk of Heaven, came out in 1986. 21 years later, he's just released his latest CD called Civilians. Here's the title track.
The carriage horses stamp and fume until our color's gone. They leave the street in black and white, bring the evening on. Let us tug their way out of gloves, out of shoes, and gray chiffon. The driver pulls his blanket high, pretends to look beyond. Pray for you, pray for me, sing it like a song. Life is short, but by the grace of God, the night is long.
Joe Henry's recent credits as a record producer include CDs by Amy Mann, Betty LeVette, and Solomon Burke. Henry also teamed with Loudon Wainwright III to compose the music for this year's film comedy, Knocked Up. Terry spoke with Joe Henry last year about his collection, I Believe to My Soul. It featured performances by Alan Toussaint, Irma Thomas, Billy Preston, Mavis Staples, and Ann Peebles.
The Ann Peebles song I want to play is not a song that you would associate with a soul singer. It's a country-flavored song written by Bob Dylan. Tonight I'll be staying here with you. How did you come up with this as a selection for her, or did she choose it herself?
You know, there's so much classic soul music from the 60s that has a lot in common with the great country music of the 60s as well. And I think the structure of the songs are, you know, wildly similar. And I don't know why it occurred to me that it was just such a beautiful song and it has such a melancholy spirit that I thought suited Anne. You know, and it was a while, when she went back and heard Bob's version, I don't think she heard it as a song for her to sing. But because I pushed her a bit, and she's a very accommodating person, she sat down at the piano one day and kind of worked out an arrangement where it sounded like a song she could have written, you know, and I think she heard it once she sat down and started playing with it a little bit.
It's interesting that you kept your confidence even when she told you it was wrong for her.
I had to do that a lot, Terry. Not with her specifically, but you know, all the artists that I worked with, I had ideas on their behalf. You know, I mean, I came out of the blue for most of these people. I don't think any of them had any idea who I was when I first got in touch. So, you know, I was, you know, having to adopt a posture of, you know, a certain amount of, you know, cheeky confidence, you know, just to start having a conversation. And I started having ideas on behalf of these artists as I started thinking about, you know, wanting to work with them.
Well, I think this sounds terrific. Let's hear Ann Peebles singing the Bob Dylan song, Tonight I'll Be Staying Here With You.
Throw my ticket out the window. Throw my suitcase out there too. Throw my troubles out the door. I don't need them anymore. Cause tonight I'll be staying here with you. I should have left this time this morning, but it was more than I could do. Strong, I've waited all day long, cause tonight I'll be staying here with you.
Joe, do you feel like you learn things about singing, working with these incredible soul singers?
Well, of course you do. I mean, and I think one thing that all these singers have in common that I worked with is none of them are the, you know, the flashy type of singer. I mean, many of them have incredible chops as singers, but that's not their orientation. I mean, there's a real understated quality to their songwriting, you know, those of them that are writers, and to their vocal delivery. And that's something that I'm really seduced by. I mean, I don't really care anything about, you know, vocal acrobatics. That just doesn't mean anything to me any more than, you know, someone playing guitar that way. It just goes right past me. But someone who is evocative in a very contained, very intimate way, I find that, you know, really compelling. And I think all these singers, you know, have that gift. So, you know, that's something that, you know, for myself, I'm always trying to do.
As a singer yourself, did you try to, like, measure your singing against theirs? Or did their singing affect you in any way? I mean, your style of singing is really different.
That's a polite way of putting it. My style of singing is very different, you know. You know, I'm as a singer, I'm a character actor. You know, I'm like the Burt Young of, you know, of singing compared to anybody I was in a room with. But yeah, of course, I hear them and I think about trying to find ways to be evocative on my own terms in the way that I think that they are evocative as singers. And that's probably the closest I can come to, you know, taking an inspiration from them directly as a singer myself.
You know, what you said is interesting about as a singer, you're a character actor. Because as a songwriter, you're a character writer. I mean, you're often writing in the voice of different characters as opposed to writing, you know, confessional, true first person kind of songs.
Oh, sure. I can't stand that, Terry.
Well, does the character writing come from feeling that you're a character actor as a singer? Like, which came first, that approach to writing or that approach to singing?
Well, I think when I started out, when I was a young, you know, I was 10 or 11, when I was listening to singers and songwriters that I found, you know, significant, and I still do, some of the same ones. I think even when I was 11 and I heard Randy Newman, I knew he wasn't writing about himself, and it never occurred to me that he should be. I thought a songwriter should have the same license that a filmmaker or a novelist has. And to that end, I've been just as influenced by great short story writers, as an example, as any other songwriters. I think it's really limiting to talk about songwriting only in terms of other songwriting.
In an article that you once wrote, you talked about the impact of hearing when you were young. Ray Charles singing the McCartney-Lennon song Yesterday and Lorne Greene singing Ringo. And you talked about how these songs really hit you in the gut because they were both about mortality and that even though you were maybe six, you realized that. So I'm interested in hearing a little more about how lyrics spoke to you when you were young, particularly those kind of songs about mortality. I mean, I remember one or two songs like that in my own life that really scared me, but I was drawn to them because of that.
Well, same with me. When I heard Ray on the radio, and I can still remember it, I mean, it would have been 1967, I think, so I would have been six, and I lived in Atlanta at the time, and I was absolutely terrified by this laying in the dark of a room and hearing Ray sing that song, and I knew that he was talking about, you know, about his ultimate death one day. I mean, it really did terrify me, but I was completely enthralled by it. I mean, I find him, you know, probably the greatest, you know, singer of, you know, of my lifetime, because I believe everything that comes out of his mouth. You know, I swear to God, when Ray was, you know, out there, you know, shilling for Pepsi, you know, I still thought it was pretty funky, and I didn't really have a problem with it.
Now, I want to play another track that you recorded, and this is for an album that you produced by the singer Solomon Burke. And he's a great soul singer who was probably best known in the 60s. This was an assignment. You were asked to produce him. But once you were given that assignment, what was your approach to working with him, and how did you try to work with him in choosing material?
Well, the first idea working with Solomon was, again, like, not to make a record he'd ever made before. So, you know, I had an idea to make a record that was for him, very stripped down and pretty rootsy, you know, kind of folksy in its nature, you know. But, you know, I told him at the time that, you know, I wanted him to be a, you know, a band leader as a singer, you know, like Sinatra was. I said, we're gonna find some songs for you to sing, and we're gonna put a band together that knows how to follow you, you know, emotionally wherever you go with the songs. That's what the arrangements will feel like. And it was all new to him to go into a studio with a band who didn't have arrangements written for them. You know, when he was making records with Jerry Wexler at Atlantic in the 60s, I think he came in and there was a band sitting there with charts, and they would run through it a couple of times. And once they had read the charts pretty well and he'd gotten a good vocal take, they went on to the next song. But the idea of kind of discovering the character of a song with tape rolling, which is the only way I know how to work, really. He'd never made a record like that before. But he had, you know, he'd bought into the idea, or at least he'd embraced the idea that he was going to let me work the way I wanted to work, whether, you know, it made any sense to him or not. So I tried to find songs that I just thought he could embody. And I, you know, I say I always take the coward's way out and, you know, hire only great musicians, because, you know, if you get people who know how to listen, you know, who are song-oriented in a room, it's not hard. It's really not hard to come up with something that's musical.
Please don't give up on me. Oh, please don't give up on me. I know it's late. Late in the game. But my true feelings haven't changed. Here in my heart, I know I was wrong. I'd like to make amends for the love that I never, ever, ever, ever shown. Just don't give up on me. Every word is true. I'll give you my everything. All of my love. All of my love. All of my love. Love, 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 love to you. Just don't give up on me.
That's Solomon Burke. More with Joe Henry after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with singer-songwriter and record producer Joe Henry.
I want to play a song that you wrote, and we're going to hear it two different ways. You wrote it, we'll hear your version, and then we're going to hear the version Madonna recorded of the same song. And I want to play this back-to-back because I think it's so instructive about the flexibility of a song to hear her version and your version. You do it completely differently, and if you weren't listening carefully to the lyrics, you might not even know it was the same song.
Well, that's happened many times. You know, I've got good friends who knew both versions of the song, and it never occurred to them that it was the same words going by. You know, it's been a really good lesson for me as a songwriter because I'm very lyric-oriented. But I, you know, I realized, you know, when that song kind of happened for her, I mean, she had a big hit with it, that, you know, it really doesn't matter what you're saying, you know, if the groove is convincing, you know, I don't know why it took me, you know, to be 40 years of age, you know, whatever I was when it came out, it took me that long to finally figure out that, you know, the groove was everything, you know.
Well, your version is a tango, and hers is more of a groove.
That's right. And I thought, you know, I thought tango is what the kids wanted, you know.
Oh, and how right you were.
Yeah. Still have my finger on the pulse of the
of the young America.
Young people.
Yes. So talk a little bit about writing the song, you know, lyrically and musically, and then we'll hear it.
Oh, you know, it's always the way. I thought the song was a complete throwaway, you know. I had just moved and set up a new studio at the guest house at my home, and was looking to just record anything, just to see if all my things were working, and I needed something to record. So I wrote that song in about 25 minutes or something, just to give myself something to do. And I was kind of embarrassed by it, to be honest. I thought it was a little bit. It starts off a little bit Spoon in June, you know. You know, it kind of takes a cryptic turn there towards the end, but you know, I just thought it was, you know, a trifle. You know, in the right hands, clearly, you know, a trifle has turned into some very handsome shoes that I'm wearing right now. I wish you could see them.
Well, I like your version a lot. So let's hear your version and Madonna's version back to back. And this is the Joe Henry song, Stop.
Tell the bed not to lay like the mouth of a grave, not to stare up at me like a calf on its knees. Tell me love isn't true, it's just something we do. Tell me everything I'm not, but don't tell me to stop.
That's Madonna back-to-back with Joe Henry, performing Joe Henry's song, Stop. Now, people might be wondering, now, how did Madonna get a hold of Joe Henry's song? And there's an interesting story behind that that starts with the fact that she's your sister-in-law.
That's pretty much the whole story. Yeah, she is. I mean, I've known her since I was 15 and she was 17. We went to high school together.
Were you dating your wife when you were that young?
No, I was not. My wife would have been about 14 or something at the time, 13. I didn't know her yet. But I became close with that whole family. There's a big kind of sprawling family. We were all living north of Detroit. And I became very close with my wife a few years down the road. And, you know, here we are.
So from what I've read, it was her idea to send your song to her sister. You were reluctant to do it.
I was very reluctant. I mean, that's just a line I don't cross. I mean, or I hadn't crossed. I mean, I have a very good relationship with my sister-in-law, and I attribute that at least in part to the fact that, you know, I don't need anything from her, and, you know, she always returns my phone calls because I'm not trying to pitch anything to her. So I wrote the song and played it for my wife, and she said, I think you should send it to Madonna. You know, she's making a new record. I think she could sing this. It'd be great. I said, you know, if I was going to pitch something, it wouldn't be this. You know, I maybe could come up with something, but it wouldn't be this. So she said, well, make me a copy and I'll send it to her. So she did, and I heard from my sister-in-law about 36 hours later, and she said, what are you going to do with this? And I said, that's just another song on the pile, you know? And, you know, she had her way with it. And, you know, I think it's fantastic.
So what was the experience like of having, a hit record on a Madonna album? I mean, the whole sense of, like, royalties from songwriting, was that something really new to you, having a hit with somebody else's version of your song, one that really
I know
paid.
What you're trying to say, Terry. I know what you're trying to say. It was new to me, of course. It had been a complete abstraction to me to see back end on anything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'd never gotten a significant royalty check in my life, you know? I live from, you know, record or publishing advances, but it was a complete abstraction to think about myself being recouped with my publisher and getting, you know, big checks in the mail. But I find I'm very adaptable. I got used to that very quickly.
Joe Henry, speaking to Terry Gross last year. His new CD as a singer-songwriter, Civilians, has just been released. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Here we go. If you fear the angels above while you sleep, then I'll be the blood you paint on your door. Your dream is a worry that nothing will keep, but time is a story and there will be more. Your dream is a worry that nothing will keep, but time is a story and there will be more. Death and disgrace can't to believe there's judgment at hand. Well, God may be kind and see you like a son, but time is a lie.
Support for NPR comes from Courgette Records, presenting Harry Shearer's new release, Songs Pointed and Pointless. Original songs, original humor. In stores, online, and at harryshearer.com. From TIAA Cref, putting the heart of a nonprofit to work for the financial future of those who serve the greater good. That's powerof.org. And from Lionsgate, presenting Away From Her, a film by Sarah Polley, starring Gordon Pinsent, Julie Christie, and Olympia Dukakis, about love, loyalty, and self-sacrifice. Now available on DVD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Romeo was restless, he was ready to kill. He jumped out the window cause he couldn't sit still. Juliet was waiting with a safety net. Said, don't bury me cause I'm not dead yet. Why don't you tell my...
Coming up, Elvis Costello. There's a new 30th anniversary edition of his album, My Aim Is True. And David Edelstein reviews In the Valley of Ella, the new film written and directed by Paul Haggis, starring Tommy Lee Jones.
When the lights went out, and I was trying to make it look like it was never in doubt. She thought that I knew, and I thought that she knew. So both of us were willing, but we didn't know how to do it. Why don't you tell me about the mystery dance? I want to know about the mystery dance. Why don't you show me? Because I tried, and I'm still mystified. I can't do it anymore, and I'm not satisfied. Pictures and in a magazine. But what's the use of looking when you don't know what they mean? Why don't you tell me about the mystery dance? I wanna know about the mystery dance. Why don't you show me? Cause I tried and I'm still mystified. I can't do it anymore and I'm not satisfied. I can't do it anymore and I'm not satisfied. I can't do it anymore and I'm not satisfied. I can't do it anymore.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. This week, Elvis Costello released a new expanded double CD edition of his first record, My Aim Is True. Here's the first song from that first album from 30 years ago, Welcome to the Working Week.
Now that your picture's in the paper being graphically admired, you can have it a one that you have ever desired. All you gotta tell me now is why, 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 why. Welcome to the Working Week. Oh, I know it don't
When Elvis Costello burst onto the pop music scene, rock critic Greil Marcus captured his essence and his individuality in a long but perfect passage. In 1977, Marcus wrote, Elvis Costello emerged in London as one of the unquestioned originals of modern pop music. Just 22 when he released his first album, My Aim Is True, he seemed master of every rock and roll move, on record and off. He combined the brains of Randy Newman and the implausibility of Bob Dylan, the everyman pathos of Buddy Holly, and the uniqueness of John Lennon. Everything was up for grabs in his music. Love, money, status, hope, fear, and, perhaps most of all, the very notion of control. No punk in terms of craft, he rode the punk wave because he communicated an authentic bitterness more than any punk. His demands on the world were more powerful, and thus his rejection of the world, when it failed to deliver, was more convincing. Unquote. Elvis Costello is still touring, still recording, and still very much loved by critics. Terry spoke with Elvis Costello in 1989.
When you started to perform, your manager gave you the name of Elvis Costello.
Yeah.
Elvis from Elvis Presley, Costello from your mother's maiden name.
No, it's my great-grandmother, actually.
Oh, yeah. I see. Okay.
You see all these things, they get like changed slightly and then it gets passed on, you know?
Well, I remember being in England in 1977 and looking at one
Don't
of the...
Don't we all?
looking at one of the magazines and seeing that great picture of you, like the one that was on the album cover of My Aim Is True, with you in the name Elvis Costello in a kind of Buddy Holly-ish pose, and it was such a striking photo. I knew I had to go hear you. And I think that's, a lot of people felt that way, even just by the photograph, that there was something happening here that was kind of interesting. Who was responsible for that pose, and how did you feel about it?
It was just a coincidence, you know. Mm-hmm. This is the happy thing about it. If it had been amazingly contrived, I think it would have been hard to sustain. I remember doing that photo session, I had two jackets at this point. That's all I had, two jackets. You know, I was trying them on, and we did some shots with this tweed jacket, and that even considering I was wearing horn rims, that seemed a little bit too serious. So I put on this other jacket, it was kind of a mohair jacket, and I said, we're happening now, and I had my electric guitar, which we didn't have plugged in, so that immediately makes it kind of comical. I think all I remember is the photographer Keith Morris and my manager, both of them guzzling bottles of cider, which was our chosen drink because it was very cheap, sort of all going, go on, throw the funny legs, you know, do some of those rock and roll, but kind of as a send-up of that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So contrary to the image of the intense, sort of furious young man that's often written about in such romantic terms by rock critics, we were having a joke at the expense of all that imagery. And people fail to see the gag, you know, obviously, because you're frozen there for a moment, and it came to represent something else, because the music obviously wasn't humorous like that. It was aggressive, you know.
Was there anything liberating for you about having a persona so that, did it help at all in pouring out your emotions, because there was something actorly about it as well?
No, because, I mean, I'd learned through a harsh apprenticeship, which I'm sure everybody, I'm not saying it was any harder for me, you know. I toughened up my voice. I knew how to sing very loud, because I'd had to shut people up in clubs when I was playing solo. I'd played in bands, and all the sort of things, the way you learn. Now, I mean, a lot of people these days might get plucked out of obscurity at 19 and turned into some sort of sensation for 15 minutes and then thrown back outside again. So I count myself as rather lucky that didn't happen, because obviously I had still a lot to learn, you know.
Right from the start, there was something really different about the songs that you were writing and the lyrics you were writing. And I think back to one of your early songs, like Mystery Dance. There's a long history in rhythm and blues and rock and roll of people writing songs bragging about their sexual prowess. And then you come up with a song about someone who doesn't know how to do it.
Well, you know, I think there should be.
I still, frustrated.
I'm still doing this, fulfilling this role as I see it. You know, you can't do it too consciously, because it's like being contrary, you know. But I do think there should be songs to sing for the people, you know, that don't have a voice. You know, there's plenty of songs that represent the other people. So once in a while, it's so easy to fall into the pattern. I thought, it isn't like saying, well, that's really me all the time. In the same way now, you know, you might sing a song that might express one point of view, which you're moved to write about that.
My guest was Elvis Costello, and you've brought a guitar with you. Would it be okay for me to ask you to sing a song?
Sure. I'll get out this guitar here. I'll sing this song I wrote in Greenland. Can I sing a song I wrote?
Sure, yeah.
This is a first on public radio. Here we go. Song written in Greenland, 500 miles above the Arctic Circle, in a place called Uummannaq. I was on holiday up there. And, you know, all they have up there is huskies and big blue icebergs and the few surviving large mammals in the sea, you know. And you know when they tell children that Santa Claus lives at the North Pole, you know? I started to think maybe God lived at the North Pole. When you look down the world at what we laughingly call civilization, these thoughts came to mind, and I made up this little story about this comedian who dies and goes to heaven and has to face his maker. Now, of course, he's made a career out of playing a drunk on stage. Do you remember those drunk acts they used to have?
Yep.
Only this guy plays a drunk priest. So being as he's been making fun of God's mercenaries on Earth, he's more than a little nervous. I wish you'd known me when I was alive. I was a funny fella. The crowd would hoot and holler for more. I wore a drunk's red nose for applause. Oh yes, I was a comical priest with a joke for the flock and a hand up your fleece. Drool and the drink and the lipstick and grease paint down the cardboard front of my dirty dog collar. Now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead. And I'm going on to meet my reward. I was scared, I was scared, I was scared, I was scared. He might have never heard God's comic. So there he was, on a waterbed, drinking a cola of a mystery brand, reading an airport novelette, listening to Andrew Lloyd Webber's Requiem. He said before it had really begun, I prefer the one about my son. I've been wading through all of this unbelievable junk and wondering if I should have given the world to the monkeys. Now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead. And you're going on to meet your reward. Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? He might have never heard that God's comic. I'm gonna take a little trip down paradise's endless shores. They say sitting here on the top of the world, I hang around in the darkest night until each beast has gone to bed, and then I say God bless and put out the light. While you lie in the dark afraid to breathe, you're begging, you promise, and you bargain and you plead. Sometimes you confuse me with Santa Claus.
It's the big white beard. I suppose I'm going up to the pole where you folks die of cold. I might be gone for a while if you need me. Now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead. And you're all going on to meet your reward. Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? You might have never heard, but God's comic.
That's Elvis Costello. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1989 interview with Elvis Costello. His introductory album, My Aim Is True, has been repackaged and expanded as a 30th anniversary edition.
You once said that you thought there was just a lot of dishonesty in most pop lyrics.
Well, there still is. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things made, a lot of small things made very large, you know, and there's a lot of talk about love, you know, but there isn't a lot of it evident. You know, there's a lot of... The word love is used a lot in songs, but I don't hear a lot of it in the subject matter, and it's not in the imagery with which the songs are presented.
Do you think there's a kind of lyric that's become bankrupt, that it's difficult to write or sing anymore?
Well, no, because whenever you just get that impression, somebody will come up and write a beautiful love song that uses all the, you know, the 18 words it takes to write a love song and really turn it on its head, you know? I mean, there's a song on the new album that my wife Cot wrote that I think is... If I had written the words, I might have been looking for, like, new words to describe those things. And sometimes you can kind of lead yourself down a blind alley by doing that because you get afraid to use the simple words that everybody recognizes because there have been surveys and all the mannerisms and everything. Can I play a little bit of this song?
Oh, sure, yeah. This is Baby Plays Around?
Baby Plays Around. See, I wrote this song. I'll just play a verse of it. This is a song Chet Baker just did before he died, and I wrote it with him in mind, funnily enough, and this is about the fifth time this has happened to me now. I write songs with no way of ever knowing whether the song's going to reach these people, and suddenly they pick it up. It happened with Dusty Springfield, it happened with Johnny Cash, it happened with George Jones, it happened with Roy Orbison, and now it's happened again. So I wrote this song, so this is the example, really, of what I'm saying. This is a little verse from a song called Almost Blue. You know?
Almost blue, almost doing things we used to do. There's a girl here and she's almost you. Almost all the things that your eyes once promised, I see in hers too. Now your eyes are red from crying. Almost blue.
See, so that song is it's fine in its own way, but it's already gets into like a lot of sort of goes a little round the houses a bit. You know, it's pretty enough. But then there's this other song, which I think is kind of a better song. So, also, I might remember all the chords of this one.
It's not open to discussion anymore. She's out again tonight, and I'm alone once more. She's all I have worth waiting for. Baby plays around, and so it it seems I've always been the last to know. To hold on to that girl, I had to let her go. I wish to God I didn't love her so. 'Cause baby plays around. I try to be strong, hold on to my pride. She doesn't even know it's wrong, how much I hurt inside. Then heaven knows I tried, but baby plays around just to play thing. It's hard to reconcile the facts I'm facing. It's not open to discussion anymore. She walks those shiny streets, I walk the worn out floor. She's all I have worth living for. But baby plays, baby plays.
And that song's on your new
record. It's on the new record, yeah. And I mean, I went out to buy a paper, and when I got back, God had written that and sung it into the tape recorder. See, but it has simpler language, and it's just the job was just to find out, you know, how to say it very plainly. And I mean, on the record, it's not a lot different to the way I played it then. There's a couple more instruments playing, but very softly. And, you know, you learn a little as you go on from listening to other things. And obviously, you start off with a model or something that might be in your head. In the case of that Almost Blue song, it was, you know, a little bit after a song called The Thrill Is Gone and a little bit after the song Gloomy Sunday, you know, the same. I wanted to create the same sort of mood. Now, that's a big task. So maybe I hadn't really learnt quite enough, and although I'm proud of the song and I'm delighted that Chet Baker did a version on it, I still think as a singer and everything, I had to learn a little bit more. And, you know, really sometimes somebody coming straight into it and just sort of like seeing exactly what they want to say, without all this stuff, you know, that you have to go through, maybe can write a song like that. And my job was just to put the chords behind the melody.
One last question. A lot of your early records were about anger and frustration, and then your songwriting really opened up to encompass all kinds of different subjects and different emotions. I was wondering if that reflected an emotional change in you, just a broadening of your music, or, you know, if you had lost any of that anger, if that was just one part of your music that we were seeing then.
Well, like I said, I made a conscious decision that I was going to leave certain things out. There are many more feelings than even, you know, 15 albums worth of songs can express. You know, we're human beings. We have to be pegged to one. You know, when people kind of go, I was in France recently, you know, and they interviewed me, and they had this very kind of limited view of from 1977 of who I was and what I was about. And they said, "So how does it feel to be Mr. 8? And I said, "What?" I said, "Is it true that you ate French people?" And I said, "No, I'm sorry to make a joke with you, but I spat them out and did it my way."
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Elvis Costello speaking to Terry Gross in 1989. His 1977 introductory album, My Aim Is True, was re-released this week in an expanded 2-CD 30th anniversary edition. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein on the new Paul Haggis movie, In the Valley of Ella. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
In 2004, Paul Haggis wrote the screenplay for the Oscar-winning Clint Eastwood movie Million Dollar Baby and wrote and directed the Oscar-winning film Crash. Several years ago, Haggis read a Playboy article about the disappearance of a young enlisted Army soldier, just home from Iraq, who was stationed at Fort Benning, Georgia. For Haggis, the article served as the inspiration for his new film, In the Valley of Ella, which stars Tommy Lee Jones, Charlize Theron, and Susan Sarandon. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Tommy Lee Jones is in nearly every frame of Paul Haggis's In the Valley of Ella. His eyes are liquid and melancholy. His face is so pitted and riven with scowl lines, it's almost porous. He plays Hank Deerfield, a retired career Army man who drives his pickup to a base in the U.S. to investigate the disappearance of his son, Mike, back only days from Iraq. Hank was once a military policeman, and for the first half of the movie, he's on his own. The local cops, among them a harried detective played by Charlize Theron, say it's an Army matter. The Army doesn't have a clue. Mike's buddies say they think he's holed up with a hot babe. It gradually occurs to Hank that these people don't want to know the truth. And the question arises, does he? His devastated wife, movingly played by Susan Sarandon, blurts out that in their family, a son who didn't fight wouldn't have been a man. And down deep, Hank knows a father who couldn't face up to his son's fate wouldn't be a man either. Haggis is not the subtlest storyteller. The first scene of his Oscar-winning film Crash made the point that racism is a very bad thing. So did the second, third, fourth, and everyone that followed. I couldn't agree more, but the film was so ham-handed that the people seemed like puppets. In the Valley of Ella is relatively restrained, but as a narrative, it's clunky. As a whodunit, third rate. And as the drama of a closed-down man's awakening, predictable. It's riveting anyway. You can't take your eyes off Tommy Lee Jones, and Haggis does justice to a great subject, the devastation of Americans coming home from a war in which their moral compass has been upended. Haggis's color palette is cold, gray, khaki, faded military green, and everything and everyone seems far away, a little stuporous. The vistas are empty. The soldiers are robotic, their language canned. But as Hank sits in his pickup, talking to one of Mike's mates, Gordon Bonner, played by Jake McLaughlin, something real and scary seeps through.
How you adjusting?
Being back? Hasn't been that long.
Call your parents?
My mom. My dad and I aren't close. Did you guys talk much?
Sure. We could have talked more. Did he ever say anything to you that I should know?
No, sir. I mean, you see a lot of shit over there. You don't want to talk about it, even with your buddies.
Yeah. But he did all right, Mike.
He was a first-class soldier. You know Mike, he loved the Army. Couldn't wait to get over there and save the good guys and hurt the bad guys. I shouldn't send heroes to places like Iraq. Everything there's f***ed up. Before I went, I'd never say this, but you ask me now, they should just nuke it and watch it all turn back to dust.
This is Jake McLaughlin's film debut. He was a gunner in Iraq, for real. But his character is an enigma, and so are the other soldiers. Something isn't right. What we see of their war is via fragmented videos on Mike's PDA, which Hank steals from his son's quarters. The device was damaged, and the techie who's recovering the videos is busy and can only restore and email them one at a time. So each piece of the puzzle arrives on cue at a strategic moment in the story. The PDA gimmick seems contrived, but the hazy images on Hank's computer screen are chilling. They echo what was shown in documentaries like The War Tapes, composed of videos taken by reservists, and accounts from places like Haditha, where soldiers stand accused of murdering civilians. Some commentators and moviegoers have asked, why spotlight only the crimes of Americans? For Haggis, it's a way of raising a different kind of flag. The movie's biggest puzzler is that title, which refers to the place where David took on Goliath. Haggis has said that the American soldiers are in the position of David going up against Goliath with only a slingshot. But that's bizarre. The U.S. is the mightier power, and David won. But I forgive Haggis for overreaching. He must have thought he needed to invoke the Old Testament to convey what he sees as a tragedy of biblical proportions.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Roberta Schirach directs the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Aeneid, Virgil's epic of the founding of Rome, in stores and online at bn.com. And from Lionsgate, presenting Away From Her, a film by Sarah Polley, starring Gordon Pinsent, Julie Christie, and Olympia Dukakis, about love, loyalty, and self-sacrifice, now available on DVD. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In 1971, Daniel Ellsberg leaked the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times. Seeking to discredit him, the Nixon White House secretly authorized the break-in of the office of Ellsberg's psychiatrist. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Bug Krogh, who pled guilty and went to prison for his role in the Ellsberg affair. He has a new memoir. Join us for the next Fresh Air.